Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is Zero Point Radio Show. Our focus is on the study of mystical, esoteric, occult, spiritual teachings and modern science, and also discussion of contemporary events and what's happening, the problems of humanity. I'd like to thank BBS Radio for the service they provide. And we're almost into the fourth year of a Zero Point Radio Show. My background, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist. I was a university professor for 12 years, worked in correctional services in Ontario, Canada for 12 years, and now I work independently under the logo of Zero Point, Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science. My regular co-host is with us today. Hi, James Moffat. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. Yep. Hi, how are you?
Good. Today, Jim, I have a few things I wanted to bring up, and then we'll continue with part two on mystical creation according to the secret doctrine. And I thought maybe we'd open the phone lines up for the second hour. So anyone, we'll try to remember to give the number out halfway through the show, but I think we almost always forget to. I thought I'd share one of my recent adventures with you, Jim.
Yeah?
You know, I had that sweet little cockatiel.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I called her Tweet, eh?
Right.
Yeah, and she used to move around the house freely, eh? Because she never really stayed in her cage. I just let her fly anywhere because there are nice big ceilings in the house here and such, eh?
Yeah.
And every now and then she'd come and land on my head. I think once before when I was doing a show, she kind of landed on my head. And if I was walking around, sometimes she'd land on my head. And unfortunately, I went outside the other day with her on my head.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and Tweet took off. And it was one of the most thrilling experiences I've had in my life, what happened. Because it was like this sweet little bird, she kind of flew up into a tree. And it's like, I can fly, I can fly. And she was like, just tweeting her little heart out, tweet, 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 tweet. And then she flew from one tree and she flew way up in the top of another tree and then she circled around the house and she came out the front here and she landed on a branch and she was just tweeting her heart out. And this other big bird kind of came down on another branch and Tweet would go tweet and the other bird would go tweet, tweet. And they were going back and forth talking to each other. It was amazing. It was so funny. It was so beautiful to see her free, and unfortunately, she flew across the river.
Oh, no.
From me. So I haven't been able to retrieve her. So I was going around the village where I live on my bicycle a little bit. And I was going around the neighborhood and I'd be going, tweet, tweet. And then I thought, oh no, what are my neighbors going to think? This character who looks like me going around the neighborhood going, tweet, tweet. So I had to let her go.
So she hasn't come back, eh? Well.
No, that's a couple weeks. It was funny. I describe it as a thrilling experience, and in a way it really was to me, and it kind of brought up things that, in a way, like what was so thrilling was to see her kind of ecstasy in being free, and kind of her self-realization, kind of like, I'm a bird, I can fly. And it was thrilling. And she just kind of went around the house and you could just feel her ecstasy in her freedom.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it reminded me also of the study of mysticism. Because I think from the very first in beginning to study Gurdjieff and the mystical traditions, I realized that in a way, I think mysticism is a route to the attainment of freedom. And I think in the study of the Gurdjieff work, it's like we began by studying how conditioned we are, how much our mind is conditioned, and how many negative emotions and imagination, and we begin to become aware of all these things in ourselves, and we start trying to strip them away. And Gurdjieff explains how everybody kind of forms a false personality, and your essence gets covered over and doesn't develop properly. So it's as though as you strip away things in your false personality, then you get more and more back into your essence. And so it's like overcoming patterns of conditioning, which Gurdjieff says have been imposed from without. Like they're not really what you are in your being, but it's how you've been conditioned or formed by things around you. So it's in a way a false self. It's your false personality. And the more you can strip that away, then the more you get back into your essential nature. And I think I've always seen, in a way, the study of mysticism has that function. It helps you to strip away these aspects of what you are not to try to get back more to your essential self. And so I remember teaching at universities. Sometimes it was so thrilling because it was like the students would be learning something that set them free in a new way. And I remember students going around, they'd be trying to learn how, you know, I used to teach. I said, anyone in my psychology courses, you have to practice self-remembering as part of the course. Because for Gurdjieff, you know, you have to study consciousness, and the only way of studying consciousness is becoming more conscious of it in yourself. So self-remembering is a way of trying to remember to be more conscious or aware of yourself as you go about your life. So I was trying to explain this to students, and then they would start doing it in their own private lives. And it was so, like, liberating to people because they would begin to see aspects of themselves, like their negative emotions and conditioning and smallness and such, and learn to struggle with those and let those things go. And I think the more you do that, it's you can attain this deeper freedom within yourself. Any comments, Jim?
Well, it's odd that you should, it's an interesting synchronicity. I've been reading Jacob Needleman's book, about God and the question of God. And in that book, he's talking about, the part I was just reading, he was talking about some interactions that he'd had with, he's a philosophy professor in California, and he taught a sort of an overview philosophy course on various religious teachings, and he talked about a couple of encounters that he'd had with students over the years, which were particularly meaningful in helping him kind of arrive at his understanding of God. And one of the things he talks about, one of the experiences he talks about having this fundamentalist Christian in one of his classes and ending up interacting with this person on some sort of essential level, having a dialogue with this person where he realized that he was able to step back from his opinions and beliefs, and that somehow that he'd had this effect on the student too, and that they were able to communicate. Even though they still didn't agree, superficially he felt they were both able to communicate more through their essence. It's a very complex kind of description that he gives, but the central thing that he talks about is about ignorance. Like he raises the example that Socrates was described as being the this wisest man in Athens, and he went around, and Socrates went around to talk to other supposedly smart people and realized that he was the wisest man in Athens because he was the only man who understood his own ignorance. And in a way, that's what mystical teachings are, provide you at the beginning, is, as you say, is that they empty you in certain ways of your attitudes, opinions, and beliefs. You realize how you've been conditioned and how much of what you think that you believe or that you think that you know or that you think that you understand, you don't really know or understand or even believe these things. These things are drummed into you and are formed in from various formed in you from various influences, from your parents, from your teachers, from media, from your peers, and really nobody knows anything when you get right down to it. That's what becomes apparent to you when you begin to really study yourself in a systematic way from a mystical perspective. You realize how little you really do know, and in a way, that's really humbling, and it's very, it's almost frightening in some ways, but at the same time, it's extremely liberating. It's like you say, you start to shed these aspects of yourself, and I mean, the obvious metaphor for that is that is in the metamorphosis of a cocoon to a butterfly, is that you have to shed that chrysalis, has to be shed, and the butterfly is, it comes from this cocoon, which had nothing, you know, which has no resemblance to what the butterfly eventually becomes. And that's really what the process of self-transformation and self-realization from a mystical perspective involves. It involves dropping who you are in order to become what you are in essence, rather than in terms of, as you say, what Gurdjieff would call personality, which is imposed on you through your conditioning and through your education. It's funny you should say that about your bird too, because I have a cat, Stretch, who's an amazing, a really amazing being. He's quite a character, and he's an outdoor cat, and he's also a fighter, and years ago he got in a very bad fight and he got quite seriously injured, and he had to wear one of those hoods because he had stitches in his shoulder and he had to wear it for 2 weeks, and he had to stay indoors, and Stretches goes nuts after about 15 minutes indoors. He cannot be indoors, so I had to keep him in for, I think I lasted 11 days, and then after 11 days I took the collar off because he was pretty much healed, and I let him go outside, and I remember watching him. He went down into the backyard, and we had a big open yard which backed onto the ravine and a wooded area, and I remember watching him. He was running across the backyard, and he was chasing a butterfly, and he was dancing, and I have never seen any being so display such joy at it being, you know, because he was free, like he was liberated from his imprisonment indoors, you know. So I quite relate.
Isn't that interesting how that experience, how that provides us with that? Eh? That sympathetic kind of feeling of the states of another.
Yeah, and as you said,
that it would affect you. Like you remember that experience clearly in your life. Like if
and as I say, it was very striking when it happened. It was like 10 years ago, and he was just pure joy. Like it was just so striking to me, you know. And I thought, God, you know, I felt so badly for keeping him inside, but I mean, he really had to. Didn't be indoors for a while to heal, but it was just like something essential in his being is that he has to be, you know, a little bit of a wildcat. He's not really a domestic indoor cat the way that the rest of the ones I have are. But that's who he is, you know. And as I say, it was just so strikingly clear that he'd, you know, he'd broken out of prison. And as you say, that's a good metaphor for there's a phrase that Gurdjieff uses about when he's talking about changing your emotional state. And I like what you said. It was like one of the things about that you realize at the beginning is how, from the Gurdjieff teaching, is how many negative emotions we have and how we're dominated by these negative emotions and how they color and they affect our every aspect of our life. And when you start to be challenged to, first of all, observe them, you're quite shocked to see how many of them there are. And then to try to begin to oppose their automatic manifestation is in a way, it's quite a liberating exercise because you realize that you can get out from under the weight of these things and you feel lighter and you feel freer when you don't just give in to them and don't just express them automatically. But in the long term, if you work on yourself emotionally, Gurdjieff says at one point, he's talking about the development of conscience, and he says that with development of your higher emotional aspects, you begin to acquire conscience. And he describes that there's a phrase, he says something that it has a taste of a very subtle but profound joy which comes into your life. And I mean, I think at times I've had a sense of what he's talking about, because I think I've had moments in my life where I've been more developed in terms of my conscience has started to awaken, you know. I mean, it generally goes back to sleep, but yeah, and I think that's what you're talking about with the bird is exactly it. It's like you lived in this very small space and you don't really realize that there's a whole other, you know, bigger, grander world outside there, and hey, I can fly, you know, I could be something quite different from what I have been.
Yeah, different things here. Yeah, to go back, pick up on a couple of things that you touched on. One was like about knowing nothing, that idea, and kind of stripping away false knowledge. And it kind of relates to why, in my own writings, I often represent myself as a fool at the zero point, and that a fool. So I represent myself as a fool, and partly I quote from Corinthians, where it says, "We speak the wisdom of God in a mystery. If any man amongst you seemeth to be wise in the world, let him become a fool, that he may be wise." And I think that's so profound. It's like becoming a fool is like emptying yourself of all that kind of false knowledge and acquired belief and opinions and attitudes and so on. And the more you can strip that away, then that creates a possibility of becoming wise. So the idea of the fool at the zero point. And the fool at the zero point also is so interesting, because in the tarot deck, the way I understand the tarot deck, it's 78 cards in the deck. And people don't realize it, but the tarot deck is really a mathematical model of the universe, but people don't understand its mathematical principles. But the way I would divide the tarot deck, you have 21 major arcana cards, which I would relate to 3 sevens. And that's the supernal or archetypal realm. And then you have the fool card, which is numbered zero. So the fool is the zero card in the tarot deck. And then you have the major arcana, which is of four suits representing the four elements. And those are pentacles representing earth, and wands representing fire, and cups representing water, and swords representing mind. So it's like the four elements in the human being, your physical nature, your emotional, your mental, and your spiritual. It's like those four cards represent those four aspects of a human being, or those aspects of your life. And so the minor arcana, it's called, is, so you have those four suits, each with 13 cards. But the fool then, in a way, the fool card is between, if you represent the tarot deck geometrically, I would represent the minor arcana of four suits as a box, as a square. And I would represent the 21 major arcana cards as a triangle, and you would put the fool would be a point in between the square below and the triangle above. And in a way, the Fool is like the portal, is like the zero point is the portal between the lower dimensions and the higher dimensions. So that's just a bit of the symbol symbolism of the Fool of the zero point that occurred to me. And it kind of relates to this idea of like, stripping away false knowledge and trying to get back to what is essential in us. And then you mentioned conscience, and I'd just like to say a few things about that. Like, as you say, for Gurdjieff, it's the beginning of awakening of conscience that it opens you up to the higher emotional center. And he says somewhere that the awakening of conscience he compares to the alchemical fire that burns away the impurities in yourself. So it's like you wake up and you see your own inherent little meanness and self-centeredness and things like that. Or you look at patterns of your life and see your selfishness and what you've been like and what you've done and so on. And as you wake up to that, you kind of go through a certain suffering of realizing your inner nothingness in a way. It's like Gurdjieff talks about this. He talks about the process of dying. He says he talks about awakening, dying, and being reborn. Now, awakening is kind of beginning to wake up and be more conscious of what of yourself and what goes on in you. And then you kind of go through a dying process, like you realize in a way your inner insignificance. And that strips that away. And then the third process is the process of being reborn. And that's being reborn and being centered again in your essence. And it's like what Gurdjieff sometimes describes it as a second education. He says we kind of grow up and we have all this rubbish that we accumulate through our education, and then we have to strip that away, and that allows the essence again to become established within our center. And so the remorse of conscience, and it's like that's what humankind needs on the planet. I look at just what's happened on the planet. Like, boy, we live in an insane asylum. We really do. It's just the world is like so crazy. Everybody's insane in a way. The wars and the cruelty and perversion. It's just like, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. You wake up to what Gurdjieff calls the terror of the situation. It's like mankind is absolutely insane. And we have countries that are run by groups of criminal psychopaths and perverts. It's terrible. And our cultures, everything's based on a lie. You know, all the lies of democracy and the lies of justice and the lies of truth-seeking. It's all so fraudulent in a way. And waking up to that, you know, I just woke up to it more deeply like 3 years ago after learning about 9/11 and then learning more and more what's going on in the world. I think before that I'd been more sheltered a bit, just being involved in my family life and mystical studies and my work, you know. And then you kind of awaken to what's happening in the world situation. And it's like humankind needs to have a remorse of conscience, you know? Like Americans need to look at what's happened, you know, how through their military and CIA and, you know, not just the Americans, other countries too. It's like we've got all these criminals who engage in criminal wars and to make money and for power and it's just terrible. You wake up to the world situation, and it's like Uspensky says, we think the world is run by conscious people. Where are they? Who are they? In fact, we see exactly the opposite. And there's such a deep truth to that, and it's like we, as citizens of the world, as planetary citizens and citizens of our own countries, we have to kind of wake up and experience remorse for what we've become, in a way, and what's been done in our name, and it's like the human race, you know, we've never had a chance. It's like all through history this has been perpetrated, like all these different wars and conflicts and hatreds and so on. And just like humankind never learns. Jim.
I couldn't get any argument from you.
I'll end there. Let you have a
I mean, you know, it's kind of it's as you say. Speeches he made, and especially in his book Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, Gurdjieff addresses this question of the terror of the situation, and he talks about. If people could awaken and really understand all the horror, and I mean he means it on a variety of levels. He talks in one speech. He says if people could understand how they're turning in circles of insignificant interests and insignificant aims, and you know they're going nowhere, and if they could wake up to that, they would see that, you know, they would understand the horror of the situation, something to that effect. And he's talking about just the horror that we all live in, this false consciousness system, and that we are ruled by sleep, and we live in a world of sleep, and you know, people that run things, as a, you know, as you say, this is Gurdjieff's speeches, that, you know, we think the world is run by conscious people. Who are they? Where are they? You know, instead we see the exact opposite, that the world is run by those who are least conscious and least aware of themselves and the meaning of things. And you see it on such variety of different levels. It's, in a way, you have to draw a certain, I think if you're going to open this door, if you're going to go through this door to study yourself in terms of a mystical or esoteric teaching, part of the price you have to pay is that you realize you see the lies and you see the horror of it, and you feel it, and you have to suffer it on some level. You have to try to deal with it consciously, because it's not pretty. And I mean, you see it in your own self. You see how this is my own experience. I won't say you didn't. Impersonally, but I'll say from my own experiences, I see how I am a sleepwalker, and how my life is lived out through me rather than me living it. And I see that I am in my personality most of the time, and that my essence is like a little kid's, and it's not very developed, you know. And that's what you have to confront within yourself. You have to suffer that on some level, and it's not pleasant. That always makes me laugh when people who don't know anything about mysticism dismiss it as being something which is for people who are intellectually lacking, and that it's some sort of source of self-consolation and self-aggrandizement. Is exactly the opposite. It's not. There's nothing consoling about it. If you know, there is, but at the same time, it's inspiring. So that's what's consoling about it. But it's not consoling to yourself. It's a teaching is there to obliterate yourself as you are, and is to put an end to yourself. I mean, it's there's nothing consoling. And it's not self-aggrandizing in the sense that your normal self isn't inflated by this. It's very humbling to see that the unreality of it all. So on an individual level, you have to deal with that. And the only thing that sustains you all through all this is that the vision that you get from it, the sense of liberation that you can taste from a teaching and from working on yourself, is enough to sustain you. Like, that's what nourishes you. That's what prevents you from sinking into nihilism or despair, or just throwing up your hands and saying, "Oh, it's all hopeless," because it isn't all hopeless, and that's what's required. That's the price you have to pay. Is you have to suffer these truths, and that's one aspect of of studying a mystical or esoteric teaching that people don't understand is that we think that all we need to do to acquire the truth is to know it with our intellects, but really to know deeper truths requires a certain level of emotional purification and emotional fire. I mean, you have to burn, you know, to be able to withstand some of these things, so to absorb these truths. Like people, I think typically if you read stories between masters and teachers, between masters and pupils, what pupils are always confronted with is that the master will present them with something which shows them something about themselves, and they have to be able to incorporate that and to be able to withstand that truth. And that's an aspect that I don't think most people understand about these teachings, is that some ways you have to be able to withstand the truth about yourself, and that's how you transform yourself, is by suffering and by giving up yourself, you know, by self-abnegation. So that's all on an individual level. Now on a more global level, that's why it's hard. Like, I mean, Gurdjieff says, you know, like, I mean, things occur in different scales for different levels of entities. So that on an individual scale, things can happen in a lifetime, whereas for a population, for a country, an area, city, for an ethnic group, for a religion, change occurs over much longer periods of time, because it's just not possible for things to be transformed in a relatively short period of time. I mean, I think that's sort of extrapolating from what he says, but I think that's the gist of it, is that everything occurs at its own, in terms of its own scale and its own timeline, but its own set of scale of time. But as he says, the advantage of the individual is that the individual is free to escape his condition, because he's so small and so insignificant in a way that it doesn't really matter to nature whether or not one individual escapes or not. You know, it's neither here nor there, and that's the paradox, is that individuals can liberate themselves, but for populations, for nations, or for religions, or for ethnic groups, it's much more difficult because of the different scale of time that they exist in. So I'm sort of going off a little bit here, but as I say, it's like when you talk about questions about the awakening of conscience, what I'll get back to is just that I think it's different on an individual and then on a more global societal scale, because I think they're occurring in different time frames. So, you know.
Yeah.
But if we could,
there's other parameters too. Like in Gurdjieff's system, like you might have certain shock points in terms of history of humankind, where there are more sudden and radical transformation or shift.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, it's so interesting when you think of Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is Gurdjieff's major book. And the setting of that is Beelzebub is this, like, higher actualized being who's in a way, comes to our solar system, and he sets up an observatory on the planet Mars, and they observe the Earth, and they, from Mars, they observe the history of humankind on Earth. And Beelzebub's visits to the planet Earth, partly it's to try to figure out what it is about the human psyche that enables what Gurdjieff calls the processes of reciprocal destruction, or more commonly referred to as war. And Gurdjieff kind of provides this cosmic perspective, like someone from outside our solar system looking at human beings on planet Earth, and kind of what is it in the human psyche that these beings, every now and then, they periodically rise up and murder each other, and how abhorrent this is, and how unnatural. So it's like it's a cosmic, you know, so he is trying to study humankind to understand what is the basis of this mass psychosis. And then Beelzebub's Tales also talks about how different what he calls sacred messengers are actualized from above, who kind of come down to the earth to try to counter this, the wars and also animal sacrifice. At one point, some of the sacred messengers come down to try to stop human beings from sacrificing so many animals, thinking that it pleases God. So, and it provides this kind of higher dimensional perspective. I've got to answer the door here, Jim. Maybe you could just carry this for a moment.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Well, interesting having a conversation with somebody who's not there. But, yeah, just in terms of what Christopher was just mentioning about Beelzebub's tales and about this idea of actualized beings coming in. It's very well, actually, I'll go back to what he said first, is that the perspective of the narrator of Beelzebub's Tales is this higher being, this actualized, self-realized being who comes from another solar system and comes to Earth and observes Earth. And in the book, you hear the history of the human race through this being's, from this being's perspective and in his terms. And one of the really interesting aspects of the way that the story is told is that you begin to the effect of the narrator's voice is to begin to distance you from human beings and everything that we've been taught about what human beings are and in the terms of their history and in terms of their essences and it's as if Beelzebub systematically punctures all these different myths about what human beings are and really reveals them to be quite different and disturbingly different from what they have always thought themselves to be and what they represent themselves to be. That's one of the most fascinating aspects of the book. It's actually very, very amusing in numerous places in the book where Beelzebub comments on human beings and as you read the book, it's odd. It's, if you can get into it, it's a very difficult book to read, especially in the first 50 pages or so. But as you continue to read, you begin to find yourself more and more appalled by human beings in a sense, and also you begin to gain a sense of the tragedy of human history it's quite a startling effect that he creates through appropriating the voice of an extraterrestrial to tell the story of the history of humanity. And then there's this very fascinating aspect which Christopher touched on about the periodic visitations to Earth by these sacred messengers who are sent from above, who are these typically these religious figures and teachers that have come to humankind in order to try to help them to overcome the properties of their psyches, which cause them to, in Gurdjieff's words, to perceive everything upside down, to see everything topsy-turvy. And the idea is that throughout history at various critical junctures, as Chris says, there are different periods. I mean, one of the most famous ones, which is discussed in the book, is a period about 600 BC when various major religious figures were alive at the same time. I think approximately the same time Buddha and Zoroaster were both alive, and there were other major figures at that period. I'm not sure exactly when exactly Confucius was around, or I think actually it was Lao Tzu that might have been the other figure mentioned. But anyway, the idea is that there have been periods in human history when there have been sort of concentrations of these higher forces and it have been manifest through these major figures who have come to humanity to teach them, to awaken them, to remind them to return to what is in essence human and what has been lost through the development of various various properties of the psyche, various malicious properties of the psyche, which result in people being asleep and being out of touch with what it means to truly be human. And as I say,
I was just thinking, Jim, and he talks about how those sacred messengers tried to help humankind by awakening in them what he calls the three sacred emotions.
Yeah, faith, hope,
I think,
and love.
Like, which was hope.
Yeah.
But he said not hope like we are, ordinary kind of hope. Actually, was it hope, faith, and love?
Yes.
Those were the traditional ways in religion. But humankind had degenerated so much that the sacred messengers couldn't even awaken hope, faith, and love in human beings anymore. So then Ashiash Shimash, which is the central character in the tales, he comes to Earth trying to awaken remorse of conscience in human beings as another way of trying to, you know, address the problems of humankind and our proclivity to war and destructiveness.
Yeah, and interestingly, in terms of what we've talked about for several weeks, and especially but over the several years, is that Ashiata Shimash is this solar entity. He's a sun being. And there's something in the name Ashiata Shimash which relates to the Persian for the sun, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And as you say, he says that the psyches of the three brain beings of the planet Earth, which is Beelzebub's term for the human beings, or the people who function intellectually, emotionally, and physically, are so degenerated that the traditional appeal to faith, hope, and love no longer fall on them and no longer awaken the sacred impulses. So the idea, as you say, is for them to experience remorse of conscience. And eventually he comes to the conclusion that the only way to do this would be to implant in humans an organ which would cause them, whenever they saw someone else, to remember the inevitability of that person's death and of their own. And this is an idea that recurs in Gurdjieff, and I know it's in Buddhist teachings too, is that the idea of, like, this is related to the awakening of conscience, and this is something that people can do. This is an experiment that they can do with themselves, which is, Gurdjieff says that everything would change if, as we went about through our lives, when we looked at people, we would be reminded of the fact that they are mortal, that eventually they are going to die, and that eventually we're going to die, and that if we could actually see everything and interact with that emotional understanding of things, everything would change in our lives. Now, this is a very peculiar idea, because it's a very profound idea in a couple of different senses. One, first of all, everybody knows that everybody's going to die and that they're going to die. Everybody knows that. You know, there isn't anybody who doesn't know that. Everybody knows that. But nobody can remember that. It's very different to know that and then to actually have the emotional state of presence in which you remember that. And I say it's an emotional state of presence because it's not an intellectual thing. It's an idea which you have to take to heart. You have to be able to, and again, it goes to what we were talking about earlier, you have to be able to suspend a lot of your normal emotional functioning and able to remember that. Because typically what happens is that we go about our lives and we're so busy reacting in terms of our mechanical emotional reactions to everything and everyone, being pissed off by what people do, being happy by what happens, but being annoyed by this, being distracted by that, that we don't really have any constant emotional state or presence. Like, we're just sort of this series of different emotional reactions to whatever is happening internally or externally to us, and which prompts these reactions. But if we, in our interactions with people, we could remember this fact, we could emotionally be present in the sense that we remembered that we're going to die and they're going to die, it would change everything. Now, the way to find out how profound this is to try to do it. First of all, you realize that it's really hard to remember this. Like, even if you set your intention, if you after this the radio program today, if you go out and you try to go about a half an hour of your life and remember that everybody that you meet is going to die and that you're going to die, and just keep that thought, keep that emotional state intact, you'll realize that you can't do it. It's impossible. But if you can do it, even for a few moments here and there, I won't describe what I'll leave it up to you to find out what happens. It's quite magical. It changes everything.
It reminds me also of Carlos Castaneda when he's learning from his teacher Don Juan, like, how to be a warrior, and he's taught that a warrior always has death at his left shoulder.
Right.
I think it was his left. I don't know. It could have been his right. But,
no,
but it was the same idea that a warrior kind of remembers the inevitability of death. And then a lot of what we put our time and attention in wouldn't have the significance we give it. It's like learning if, for instance, you realize you only have 6 more months to live.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, what's important in your life is something very different. You would want to kind of be with those you loved, and you'd want to speak from the heart to them and resolve your problems with them and try to resolve past things, and and you wouldn't be so attached to, you know, possessions and acquiring wealth. I've heard people say, you know, you never see a U-Haul following a hearse. You can't take, you know, no matter how much the psychopaths in the world can own millions and billions of dollars, like, it does them no good. You can't take it with you.
Oh,
you know?
Damn.
So in another scale, or, you know, these things have no intrinsic value, you know, that things that people want to pursue their life and for self-aggrandizement and power, and then yet at death it just levels us all. And I guess that's part of the idea what Gurdjieff is saying. If we remember the inevitability of our death, a lot of things that are important to us will just fall away. And that helps us to attain wakefulness.
Yeah, I think actually that's, yeah, that's exactly it. And I think also, too, it's interesting. You're 60 years old. I'm 60 years old. I was saying this to somebody the other day, that the best part about getting older is that, older, is that you realize that I find that so many things that emotionally would have dominated me earlier in my life, they have no meaning to me anymore. I feel much more liberated because I just feel that there's less that I'm concerned about. And it's exactly what you're talking about. It's like, it's a lot of these things that when you're younger have such importance to you, just don't have that much importance to you as you get older. And if you can drop things, that's very liberating. And I think that as you get older and come closer to the, you know, you become more aware of your own mortality, you realize that, you know, it's just not worthwhile investing yourself in so many and identifying yourself with so many of the things that previously that you thought were important.
And it's interesting also at the same time, if we realize the inevitability of our death, certain things lose their significance. But what attains significance is your soul life.
Mm-hmm.
Because for Gurdjieff, like, although the physical body dies, and he calls it a sacred rascuerno, or separation of parts, but there is an inner being, and that is freed from the physical body at death. And for Gurdjieff, if we can attain to our spiritual body, he says we can attain immortality within the limits of the solar system. So Gurdjieff is saying we have to realize how mortal we are, but at the same time, it's like what we have to put something up in heaven to attain our spiritual body, which then gives us another level of immortality. And another very interesting teaching in Beelzebub's tales, Gurdjieff explains that that human beings can live and die according to two principles. And one principle they can live and die with, he says, is the same principle that governs the life of one and two-brained beings, like animal forms. And he says when animals die, their life energies feed the moon and feed the earth. Like their energies go back into the earth, the body disintegrates and returns to the earth. And he says the soul, certain soul energy passes to the moon. So Gurdjieff, one of the things he says about war is that war, in a way, feeds the moon. Because when you have all these souls dying, it feeds the moon. And people that in their soul bodies, he actually says, come past to the moon. At one point, Gurdjieff associates the hell worlds with the dark side of the moon. So upon death, we can feed the moon. And that's what he says happens with one or two brain beings. But then the possibility is that if a person attains to their spiritual body, then the inner man or woman or being can survive and continue on even within spiritual planes of being. And that's kind of, for Gurdjieff, that's what's serious, is that we have to develop our higher being bodies so that at death we don't just pass to the moon and back into the earth, but that we attain to the level of the planets or to the particularly the level of the sun, which for Gurdjieff is related to our spiritual body. And it's also interesting in a way how people, when they have near-death experiences, and they describe going down a tunnel into a realm of light. And this is so common, and in this realm of light they encounter other spiritual beings, and they have this kind of inner experience of blissfulness and illumination. And most people don't want to come back. But what's remarkable about this, like, if we were to take these accounts seriously and we would say, well, where could this kind of great body of radiance be? And it's obvious that we would associate it with the sun. Like, if we were to look in the outer world, well, how could we pass down a tunnel into a realm of light? Where would that light be? And it would obviously be the sun, because that's the source of light and life within our solar system. And for Gurdjieff, in a way, we come from the sun, not the physical body, but the inner man or woman. And Blavatsky's the same way. Blavatsky says the solar pritis, or the solar intelligences, form the inner man, whereas the lunar pritis, or intelligences, form the astral body, and in conjunction with the earth pritis, or intelligences, they form the physical body. So it's like these different levels of the cosmos are related to our different bodies. So in Beelzebub's tales, Gurdjieff says what's natural to human beings is that we should be feeding the sun and attain to the sun upon our death. But the condition of the psyche of humankind became so degenerate that instead people die as other animals and serve only lower cosmic purposes and don't attain to their higher self or develop the higher faculties latent within them. And then he says when the psyche of human beings becomes so degenerate and low, then they don't feed the moon very well. So the moon requires more human death in order to be sustained by enough, he calls them Asokan vibrations. It's all very interesting teaching. But this idea that, like, what is the sun? And a lot of people, like some people who are Christian and Jewish or other religions, I think they often see, they have a negative view on what they would call pagan belief. And one kind of like a pagan belief would be to regard the sun as, like, to worship the sun. Okay, might be regarded as a pagan belief in a derogatory way. But in a way, in mystical traditions, it, as Aleister Crowley says, he says the sun is God's representative here on earth. So people who worship the sun, it's not exactly that you're simply worshiping the sun. Well, you are worshiping the sun. Not that you see the sun as God, but rather that the sun embodies that higher spiritual intelligence and being. So the sun is like God's representative here on earth. So to worship the sun is perfectly natural. And we should, in a way, worship the sun. That doesn't mean, that doesn't deny the importance of Christ or other figures, but there's nothing so derogatory about worshiping the sun. If we look at the sun in the solar system, all of human life on planet Earth has evolved under the influence of the sun. It provides a structure to the solar system, and the light and the heat of the sun give life within the solar system. So to see the sun as God's representative, there's nothing, well, I mean, it is a pagan belief, but it's also is a scientific view in terms of trying to understand mystical realities. Yes, the sun is a level of spiritual, it does embody spiritual intelligences. So when people actually travel down that tunnel into a realm of light, well, lo and behold, maybe that's exactly what the mystics have said, is that the sun is like a higher spiritual world. And this is in yoga, in the Vedic teachings. There's Surya Yoga, which is the yoga of the sun. And the sun is identified with manas, or higher mind. So the yogi aims to attain to the sun. You know, we are sons of the sun. And you find the worship of the sun in Egyptian mysticism and all throughout the occult traditions. And it's a shame people, who, like a lot of Christian people, think there's something evil or negative about such pagan belief. But I think they've completely lost contact with the esoteric side of their own religion. And even in the Bible, I think we, you know, Christ is seen as the son of the sun. So I think people have lost touch with that esoteric side of their own religious teachings. But it certainly gives us a different view, Jim, on like the possible relationship of a human being to the larger cosmos. I mean, it's really quite inspiring to think that we can attain higher spiritual bodies and have continued existence.
Well, like
within
you say,
other dimensions.
When you talk about the sun, too, I mean, it's, you know, you can talk about the physical sun, but then there's the hidden sun, or the you know, the higher dimensional sun. I mean, there's the sun out there, which, as you said, one time, this is many years ago, we were talking about something, and you started talking about the sun or something, and you said, yeah, this is many, many years ago. This is 30 years ago. And you said, yeah, the sun isn't an intelligent being. It just keeps all life on Earth going. And you know, I was kind of thinking, well, you know, the sun is, science teaches, this is, it's just this big bag of gas, basically, that, you know, burns. And I had a moment kind of just, when you said that, of kind of seeing things from a completely different perspective and realizing, oh, yeah, you know, I guess if you're going to apply the word intelligence to something that keeps all life on Earth alive would have to be seen as an intelligence, you know? Like, it was,
yeah,
just,
even more intelligent than us.
Yeah, well, smarter than Carl Sagan, you know? Like, I mean, you know, it's really something when you think in those terms. And then, as I say, there's the sun, there's the physical sun, but then there's this whole idea stars and planets have these higher dimensional aspects to them too, and that they have, that they're beings, that you know, that in Gurdjieff's teaching, you know, the earth is a great being, and so they're not just these physical material objects, but are governed by these material processes, but that they have intelligences and spiritual dimensions associated with them. It's a completely different way of looking at things. It's like in this way, the cosmos isn't just this, inanimate structure in which we exist, but that everything has an inherent intelligence and has a higher dimensional aspect to it. So it's a completely different way of looking at things. And one thing I wanted to mention one thing about Ashiyat Shemash. I was trying to find this explanation of the derivation of the name, because I know it's related to Zoroastrianism and to the sun, but I couldn't find it. But one thing I did find was in Michel Waldberg's book, because he talks quite a bit about Beelzebub's tale, Gurdjieff, an approach to his ideas. And one thing he mentions about Ashiyat Shemash is that when he is incarnated and comes to Earth, he never addresses the three-brain beings of the planet Earth directly. See, his teachings are always somehow encoded or somehow indirectly transmitted to human beings. So it's not like, just given to them in a direct manner, like a straight teaching. I think that's very interesting. I mean, again, it kind of reflects what Gurdjieff's doing in his book. He's not teaching people in a straight forward fashion. He's trying to teach them allegorically. He's trying to get them to feel things and to appeal to aspects of them that are generally underdeveloped, and trying to awaken aspects of them to know things in a way quite different from the way that they know things. And that's true of all the great teachers, the messengers from above. They don't address human beings directly. They teach in parables. They teach in allegories. They teach somehow indirectly. Through myths and symbols, what we've been talking about the last several weeks.
Yeah, Beelzebub's tales to his grandson is one of the most unusual and deep and provocative books of the last century, and it's almost completely unheard of. It, like, you compare Gurdjieff's philosophy and teaching in that to modern philosophy and academic science and academic philosophy, It makes the latter seem puny, and yet, as you say, I mean, it's a very complex book, and it's written allegorically, and there's kind of different keys to understanding and interpreting it.
Yeah,
it's certainly a remarkable book. I remember with Carl Sagan, I think the difference between a modern materialist science perspective and a mystical perspective. From a scientific perspective, Carl Sagan looks out into the cosmos and he says, is there intelligent life out there in the universe? And from a mystical perspective, life and intelligence is everywhere. It's in the sun. So it's from a mystical perspective, you might ask, is there intelligent life on Earth? Instead of, is there intelligent life in the universe, you turn it around and it's like humankind is so, in a way, unintelligent, so unenlightened.
Yeah, and also it says to also ask, within yourself, is there deeper intelligence within your own being than what you normally take to be your intelligence? This is the whole idea is that's missing from conventional modern thinking, is that there's no recognition that there are higher aspects of consciousness which people are capable of developing and realizing within themselves, which completely transform our way of knowing and understanding things, and which reveal to us much of what is hidden from the normal rational mind and from our normal sensory way of knowing is very limited, and these things become apparent when we develop these faculties, that there are actually higher faculties of knowing and understanding that are related to these higher states of consciousness and within our own being. Like, if you can look out in the cosmos, say any intelligent life out there, The irony is that you can look within your being and you can develop the worlds within your being and know yourself and know the cosmos. It's very peculiar, but it's, you know, that's the essential teaching in the mystical and esoteric tradition, is that you don't have to fly to the moon to know the moon. You don't have to fly to the other planets. You can go there. You can go there by developing your own being.
Yeah, Gurdjieff says all these levels of the cosmic order have their correspondences within ourself.
Yeah.
So we can study like what is the moon? So what is the moon in ourselves? And what is the sun? And what is the sun in ourselves? Jim, I did want to make a couple notes which I'd forgotten to make at the beginning of today's show. So before I forget, I'm going to just bring these two things up. One is I just want to tell BBS radio listeners that I'll be on Don Nikoloff's Evident Footprints on Thursday night of this week. Well, actually, here in Ontario, it's Friday morning at 1 a.m., but I usually think of it as a Thursday night show on Don Nikoloff. And, yeah, so I'll be there on Thursday. And, Don has, I sent Don a copy of my book, Jim, and he, in an email, he described this one phrase. He said, thank you for your contribution to humanity. He used that phrase. I think Don, it really kind of sees the kind of importance and profound nature of the Heart Doctrine book.
So that's Thursday night, 10 Pacific, 1 a.m.
1 Eastern.
Eastern, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and Don has such an interesting show. I often stay up and listen to it, even though it's very late here and it kind of throws my time off a little bit. And the other thing I did want to encourage people, you can buy a copy of The Heart Doctrine. I've been selling very few copies of that, which is a bit discouraging, but it's going to take time to promote it and for it to get out. You can buy The Heart Doctrine through Amazon anywhere in the States, and it's $24.95. And I don't know if they have extra taxes and mailing costs on that. But the book is available now through North America, even though I'm not sure it's available through Amazon in Canada or not. I've not really checked that. But I would encourage people, it's a complex book, but there's a lot of content to it. And no matter what your religious background, whether Jewish and interested in the study of Kabbalah or Christian or Hindus or other occultists or even Muslim, I have a chapter on Muslim and Sufi teachings in it, and it really shows the commonality of the Heart Doctrine across different religious and mystical traditions, and I think it's a very, very profound book. So I do encourage people, buy a copy of The Heart Doctrine, and I don't think you'll regret it. I hope it will become a classic. I don't really know of any other contemporary book on the nature of human consciousness that presents such a model of what we are as human beings as this book presents. Both its uniqueness in saying that human consciousness and self-existence originates out of the heart rather than being a product of the mind in the head. And mystics often define self-realization as involving the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So the idea in mystical traditions is the first level of awakening is the awakening of the heart. And Gurdjieff calls it the higher emotional center. And he tells a very interesting story in Beelzebub's Tales to his grandson, where Beelzebub is talking and he says, that in beings like Beelzebub and his grandson Hasin, that their emotional center is related to an organ in the region of the breast, which I would take to refer to the heart. But he says in humankind on planet Earth, the emotional center shifted from the organ in the region of the breast, and it was distributed throughout the autonomic nervous system, which is a nervous system it's outside of the central nervous system, and it has a series of major plexi in the body. You have a heart plexus, a solar plexus, a hypogastric plexus. So you have this autonomic nervous system. And Gurdjieff says that our emotional center shifted from being in the heart into the autonomic nervous system. And so my interpretation of this is that what we as human beings, we want to be transformed within ourselves to once again awaken to the higher emotional center, which is the awakening of the human heart. So anyway, I realize, Jim, that's the one thing I don't have in the heart doctrine is my explanation of how the heart doctrine is in Gurdjieff's teaching. I don't have a chapter on Gurdjieff. Well, I mean, I have a chapter on Gurdjieff mainly explaining how asleep humankind is and trying to explain what self-remembering involves, because I try to make the book a practical book to do some teaching in it that people can use to study consciousness in themselves. But in a way, you know, I always felt that in my book, The Slugs, which explains some of Beelzebub's tales, you know, I have that chapter explaining that story on how Beelzebub says our emotional center shifted. And that's the one chapter I don't have in the heart doctrine, even though, yeah. Anyway, so those are, thanks, Jim. I didn't want to forget to announce being on Don Nikoloff's show Thursday night, and also to encourage people to buy the Heart Doctrine book.
Yeah, it's, by the way, it is on Amazon.ca. Do you know that there's another book called The Heart Doctrine by a guy called William Q. Judge? And it looks like he's a theosophist. He's written several books, Ocean of Theosophy, Yoga Aphorisms.
Yeah.
Patanjali, Bhagavad Gita, Book of Devotion. Yeah, because I recognize that name. But also there's another book, and it looks, I just read the table of contents while you were talking, about by Catherine Tingley, called Mysteries of the Heart Doctrine, which looks very interesting, a theosophical perspective, and has material on Madame Blavatsky, and looks like a very interesting, okay, that's, I guess, she got a long name, Catherine Augusta Westcott Tingley, but...
theosophists.
Yeah,
because I took the term, the heart doctrine, her book called The Voice of the Silence.
Right, but you are on Amazon.ca now, because you weren't
good.
Before, but yeah, so it's there.
Yeah, good.
Yep. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, well, you know, I'll say it again, I've said it several times, and obviously, given the fact that I've been involved with you and helping you with this book for a long, long time in terms of writing it and rewriting it and trying to revise it and trying to polish it and refine it, but at the same time, I mean, just speaking as objectively as I can, I don't know of any book in modern consciousness studies that is like this at all. I think this is an extremely unique, extremely profound, extremely brilliant piece of scholarship. It's a wonderful book. And anybody who has a serious interest in anything esoteric or metaphysical or mystical really should buy this book and read it. You will not be disappointed. It's not easygoing. So parts of it are very readable, and parts of it are very accessible, but other parts of it are difficult, and you can't kind of absorb it all in one sitting, that's for sure. But at the same time, it just has such a unique perspective in it, and it does something that I think, and this again, I think in part reflects your Gurdjieff background, Chris, is that it's both psychological and cosmological, and I don't think anybody links the psyche and the cosmos in the same way that you do in this book, and I think it provides an entirely different model of consciousness, which allows people to see a number of significant questions through an entirely different set of lenses, and at the very least, even if there are certainly parts of it that are profoundly insightful, but at the very least, it provides a way of questioning all our normal assumptions about everything from the nature of what it means to be human to the nature of the cosmos and everything in between. It has such application on such a variety of levels to such major enigmas and anomalies, both scientifically and in terms of personally our search for meaning. It's a wonderful book, and I would highly recommend it to our listeners. I mean, anybody who's stuck with us this long would probably be interested anyway, but I would, you know, as I say, that's what I'll say. It's certainly worth purchasing, and I think it's head and shoulders above anything else that I know of in terms of modern consciousness writing. I think it's the best book I've read about consciousness.
Well, it certainly raises, like, fundamental, it provides a fundamentally alternative perspective on the issues of consciousness. And I wouldn't consider that my book proves the case. Like, I'm not even arguing that.
No.
But it's all consistent. It's what's amazing about the Heart Doctrine is the commonality of this teaching to all these esoteric religions. That is profound. You know,
yes.
You have a chapter on the Dalai Lama, you have a chapter on Aleister Crowley, a chapter on the Bhagavad Gita, a chapter on Muhammad, a chapter on esoteric Christianity, a chapter on Kabbalah. And you're seeing how the Heart Doctrine is elaborated in all these spiritual teachings. And I think that's really important, because I think people on this planet, religion is perceived as such a source of conflict between people, but I think if we understood the esoteric side of religion, it would serve to unite people of religious persuasion, that we can respect each other's religious traditions, and they are, it's like, who compared, Hilton or someone compared religion like a diamond, and the light shines through it and you have all these different reflections of that same truth? And it's like all the different religions have that same truth of the Heart Doctrine in them. And then the other thing in the book is that it actually proposes this most unusual concept of human beings as having a zero point center.
Yeah.
And I don't know anyone else in the consciousness literature who argues such a perspective. It's a very radical alternative idea that we have a zero point center related to the heart. And it's hard to, I'm not going to try to go all into what that entails. It's very complicated. But, we had a guest a couple weeks ago mentioned that physicist.
Oh, yeah.
Who's saying that the sun has a white hole, black hole, zero-point singularity center. But I don't think he considers human beings to have a zero-point center. And I don't think people like Greg Braden, who wrote, Awakening to Zero Point, like what he's talking about is zero points in terms of the cycles of human evolution, when you come to a period between different cycles. But I don't know. I do you know of anyone, Jim?
I don't know of anyone. And I would say that, well, again, as you say, I think on one level the book is really incredible in terms of, I don't think even a lot of people who are well informed about mystical and esoteric teachings probably recognize that this Heart Doctrine runs through all these teachings. I was shocked when you first started developing this. And I remember telling you at one point, you have too many quotes from too many different people saying the same thing. Like, you know, it's kind of almost overkill because it was in everything. But then to this point about the 0 points, no. And see, this is what's so amazing about this book and about your work, I think, in general, is that everybody who writes about consciousness, and many of the people who have even have an esoteric mystical perspective, such as Ken Wilber, they're still talking about consciousness as somehow arising out of the brain, you know, and we have all these different attempts to explain how consciousness could arise from the brain, but nobody really can explain how it arises from the brain, and nobody speaks about it in relationship to how it might manifest through the consciousness might manifest through the heart, but more importantly, that the idea of how consciousness is stepped down from these higher dimensions, and what's interesting about the so fascinating about the 0 point idea is that this provides a fundamental explanation of what the word isn't mechanism, but what the nexus is between these different dimensions. The 0 point provides a hypothesis to explain how this could happen, and that is utterly, you know, fantastic and utterly provocative, and certainly needs to be explored and examined in much more detail. Again, what makes me think two of the things that really convince me is that this is entirely consistent and congruent with what's taught in esoteric teachings about the heart and about how it's possible to know yourself by realizing yourself within this point within the heart. But also, like, it's so consistent with ideas in modern science. And if it's true that as above, so below applies, or that man is a microcosm and the macrocosm, then you would expect this. You would expect there to be some sort of cosmological. We have to have evidence of cosmological explanations which are applicable on the psychological level and on the human level. And that's exactly what this provides. Like, it's almost too good to be true in a sense, but at times that's kind of my feeling when I'm reading it. But at the same time, it's like, you know, as you say, you're not claiming that you've proved this or anything, but it's a way of looking at things. And what's so useful about it is, see, as somebody who's trained as a psychologist and somebody who's interested in the nature of the study of consciousness, I think, to get back to our first point of the program, I think people have to empty themselves of all these ideas about what they think they know and what they think they understand about consciousness, because from a mystical and esoteric perspective, I see modern psychology and science as being completely riddled with all sorts of wrong assumptions about the nature of consciousness, which really hinder and have really distorted their understanding of consciousness. I think they're very, very far off in the wrong direction and looking in the wrong places for consciousness, and have fundamentally wrong ideas about it, that it's somehow something that's produced in the neurochemical processes of the brain. I think that's completely wrong, and this is a way of understanding an alternative model which would show that it's completely wrong.
Yeah, it would be really, I would love to have some scientists who are critical of the position, like critique it,
yeah,
and argue the case.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Rather than just saying it's ridiculous.
yeah, rather than simply being dismissive of the concept without reading it. What's also amazing to me about, like, the perspective on the heart doctrine, I just love that pointing game.
Yeah.
Like, I went and visited the local yoga center the other day, and I offered them that they could do yoga classes on my lawn down by the river, eh? And I kind of explained the idea of my book to the woman at the yoga center, and I got her to do the pointing game, where you point to the wall, and you point to the ceiling, and you point to your left foot, and you point to your right ear, and then you point to yourself. And she pointed immediately to her heart.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like she saw immediately, like, the essential point of the book, which is arguing that the I experience in the human being is centered in the heart. It's not produced out of material processes up in the brain. And you just see how few people in pointing to themselves ever point to their heads. Like, it's just very few people. Sometimes people point to their throats as though they're uncertain about the relationship of the mind to the heart. But generally, people point to the heart to indicate I. So it's not only that, but many other clinical observations make the heart doctrine a very serious scientific, alternative scientific perspective on the issues of consciousness. Like this idea that I developed the in the body, I'm not saying that the consciousness is only in the heart. That's not at all what I'm saying. Because people will then say, oh, well, I think I'm conscious in my mind, in my head. And which I would say, yes, I'm not doubting that at all. I'm saying consciousness can be distributed through the body and that it's actually related to the blood flow. And there are even very practical exercises you can do to demonstrate that. And in my lectures, I get people to put their hands together. And usually people's hands are about the same size. And I get a person to spend 30 seconds simply being aware of one hand and putting their consciousness into one hand and then putting your hands back together. And you'll find that the hand that you put your consciousness into is enlarged, because when you put your consciousness in your hand, there's increased blood flow to it, so it enlarges your hand. Now, how can you explain that data with this concept of consciousness being produced simply up in the brain? There's no way in accounting for that direct evidence that concerning blood flow in the body. So this whole idea of consciousness being connected to blood flow, and then also consciousness being connected to the subtle anatomy and the chakras and such. But that's on a different level. In the physical body, I'm saying consciousness is connected to blood flow. And again, that's a scientific idea. Doesn't mean it's right, but it's a hypothesis. It's a way of thinking about what consciousness is. And you can see from the modern literature on consciousness, scientists have no idea of what it is or how it's produced by the brain. So when there's so much uncertainty about consciousness, it even adds credence then to considering alternative perspectives. And this certainly provides that. See, most scientists think consciousness is produced by material neurological processes, and that when the brain dies, the consciousness is no more. Isaac Asimov describes us as like simply an assembly of molecules or cells. Or Francis Crick, he says we're nothing but a pack of neurons. Okay, so if that's true, then consciousness can't persist beyond death, because it's only a epiphenomena produced by material processes. But in this view, we can have a zero point center within the, and it's related to the higher dimensional physics, to the human heart. See, I'm actually saying there's a higher dimensional holographic physics to what the human heart really is. The human heart's not only a material organ, mass of soft muscle tissue in the chest. It's not only that. Beyond that is a psychical heart, a spiritual heart, and a divine spark, ultimately, connected to the heart. So I'm saying there's this whole higher dimensional physics to the human heart, so that when death comes and the body dies, that doesn't extinguish consciousness. You still have this being center, which is actually established in higher dimensional space. So it's certainly a very different perspective, and it deserves to be considered scientifically, because in a way, this type of perspective is consistent with all the evidences for psychical phenomena, out-of-body experiences, existence beyond death, visions of an afterlife, you know, this type of perspective allows you a framework within which to understand all those data of paranormal studies, which most scientists simply ignore because it's not consistent with their material viewpoint. I heard a beep, Jim. I don't know. Did we have someone a call?
No, that was my computer.
Okay.
I was looking for something. Yeah, it's funny because when you're saying that a bit, about it's a hypothesis that, you know, that about scientists claiming that consciousness arises from the brain, you know, and there's a quote from John Searle when he's speaking with Susan Blackmore in Conversations on Consciousness, that book, and he says, well, the one thing we do know is that all of our conscious experiences arise from the brain, every damn one of them, you know. And I wrote about that, and they sound suspiciously like a man who might beat appliances when they don't work correctly. Like, I mean, he somehow seems to think that if he says it very forcefully, it makes it true. But there's absolutely zero evidence, I mean, that every damn one of our conscious experiences arises from the brain. And there isn't any evidence for that. That's completely wrong. You know, I mean,
yeah.
Obviously you need a brain to have consciousness, but that doesn't mean that consciousness arises from your brain. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition for consciousness. And as you say, blood flow somehow, I don't know, it's so peculiar. It's like it fits in with the whole very strange history of modern psychology, but the idea that something as obvious as blood flow has been completely missed by people talking about consciousness. So when you're sexually aroused, you have blood flow to your sexual organs. That's where your consciousness is. It's not in your head. I mean, that's where it's centered. This whole idea that consciousness can be centered in different parts of your body, which is a basic proposition in Gurdjieff's teaching, is so self-evidently true that it's amazing that Western psychology hasn't grasped this. When they're talking, but they're so stuck in their little search in their heads for everything that they've completely missed the importance of this. It's quite astounding. And I mean, it's not like there aren't clues to it. I mean, yogis have been talking about blood flow for about 4,000 years practicing, you know, the refinement of blood flow. And this idea of, it's ironic, that an MRI works on, my understanding is that how an MRI works, it's in part the contrast of oxygenated blood and deoxygenated blood, which is basically what yogis try to do, is they try to oxygenate the blood, right? And so we have a machine that, you know, that tracks blood flow, but we have people who study blood flow within themselves. And, you know, who do you think knows more about consciousness and how it relates to the blood? You know, the people who want to look at the machine and blood flow in your brain, or people who can actually manipulate their consciousness through blood flow. It's really quite astonishing when you look at it objectively, how modern scientists, so completely gone, I in my opinion, completely gone off the track and is really strayed badly and doesn't really, I think is completely mistaken on a number of essential issues in the study of consciousness. Of course, the most important thing that modern science doesn't recognize is that the most meaningful study of consciousness is to study it within yourself. It's not a phenomena which really, I mean, you can study consciousness and others indirectly, but if you want the most scientific, in the sense of coherent and objective study of consciousness, you have to study it within yourself. You can't study it within other people.
Yeah, it's amazing how much modern psychologists have not considered self-study as part of psychology. And I remember that was one of the most profound things I learned from Gurdjieff early on, is like, because I was interested in the study of consciousness within Western psychology. And then I began to read Gurdjieff, and he says, well, if you want to study consciousness, there's only one way you can do it, within yourself. And he said, this is a wholly different psychology than what we've become accustomed to. And that's exactly, as you say, yogis and so on have been studying consciousness within themselves for thousands of years. And then what we have is the kind of academic scientists who study consciousness, mainly they think about it and they use their mind to try to analyze it, but they don't study what it is within themselves with the idea of becoming more conscious. I mean, that's the other thing Gurdjieff says.
He says,
we don't understand consciousness largely because we're not properly conscious. And it's hard for someone to... I mean, he wouldn't say... In another way, he's saying everyone has relative consciousness, he calls it, but we don't have true self-consciousness. So we can't really understand what consciousness is because we have so little of it.
Yeah, and the other part of that is that you know, realistically, in modern psychology, there's really only two conscious states recognized. There's sleep and there's the waking state, and it's very simplistic, and there's no recognition of the reality of higher states of consciousness as being realizable and as being differentiated from the normal waking state of consciousness. So everything has been smeared out into this, to the flatland of the relative state of consciousness, and nobody wants to recognize, again, what I was speaking about earlier, that there's a possibility of acquiring these higher states of consciousness, and that with them, the faculties of knowing and understanding, which would transcend our normal faculties of knowing and understanding. And once you have that perspective, it changes everything, because then, as you say, like what you just were saying about how this model allows for the apprehension of various psychological paranormal phenomena, which are inexplicable within the normal framework, become totally explicable because they make sense within this broader framework. Well, the same thing is true once you recognize the existence of higher states of consciousness, many enigmas and mysteries and anomalies that defy reduction to the conventional wisdom in modern psychology and science become explicable because you have a completely different understanding, a different model to apprehend these phenomena, which to place them. That's the problem. Like Ken Wilber says in his book, The Marriage of Soul and Spirit, I believe that's the title. He talks about the collapse in the relative last couple of hundred years, the collapse of the great chain of being, and how everything has been reduced the great chain of being has been reduced, and you have the basic flatland in which everything is explained in terms of just the waking state of consciousness. There's no longer any differentiation, no longer any recognition of higher levels of being and consciousness, no recognition that the universe might consist of different levels. And yet, we're the only people in the history of humankind that, you know, 20th century post-technological societies are the only societies that don't believe in the great chain of being. This is a very relatively recent phenomenon in human history where this, like the ladder of creation, is no longer said to exist. It's said to be a myth, and that's directly attributable to the whole intellectual development since the Enlightenment, which has been to grossly oversimplify and reduce everything to the material reductionist perspective, but which is a very useful way of looking at things for a variety of reasons and for a variety of uses. But it's not a comprehensive perspective to describe ourselves or the universe. And in fact, it distorts everything by reducing all these higher dimensions. Once we do that, we're cut off from our metaphysical and our religious roots. And that's what is the definition of absurdity is. It's absurd. We're cut off from our roots and from our higher dimensional origins and sources of intelligence and being.
Yeah, we just see it in the history of science for the past century or longer. It has been basically the dismissal of the idea of human beings as having a spirit or soul. And so people who study consciousness, because of that paradigm of modern thought, they haven't really explored these alternatives to modern views of consciousness. Because if you go into the psychology of spirit and soul in different religions, that's where you find the heart doctrine. So it's this view of consciousness produced by the brain. It's kind of also a function of this kind of materialist neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory. So as you say, we don't have a view that there's a great chain of being, that there might be higher dimensions or spiritual beings on other planes or spiritual forces in other dimensions that help to manifest what is made manifest in the material world. I think that's another interesting, unique kind of feature in this book also, is this whole concept of within, without, from zero points. Because often I think people think of there being a hierarchy of being, but often we portray that as though it's above, like, you know, beginning at the bottom and you have these levels above, whereas really it's not hierarchical. But the hierarchy is from within, without. That's how the hierarchy occurs. Like the highest level within is this like point source divine spark, I would say, in higher dimensional space. And that's like the ultimate within. And then that spark is clothed in different bodies which surround the divine spark. So it's from the hierarchy of being. It's not hierarchical like extended in external space. It's more within, without. And that also is really a very valuable concept and teaching. It helps to cultivate an alternative concept of what space is. And because we live in space. We exist within space. In the Bible, they talk about him in whom we live and move and breathe and have our being. Well, we live and move and breathe and have our being within space itself. So we need to understand this concept of there being higher dimensions of space, and that the phenomena are produced from within, without. So that, again, it's another element that's really quite unique in this book. And yeah, the zero-point teaching, the heart doctrine, and the within-without concept. And I think, Jim, the other thing that is relatively unique in my writings, especially in my other books, is this concept of how we have this formula of how God is first one, then three, then seven. And how that concept is another concept that you find in diverse religious and esoteric teachings, is that the basic idea of the one, the three, and the seven. And you find that in yogic Vedic teachings, in Tibetan Buddhism, secret doctrine, Gurdjieff, Kabbalah, Judaism, Sufism, you find that 1-3-7 pattern again in all these esoteric traditions, but I think we've never understood these basic concepts. I've never heard anyone in the educational system or even within the mainstream of science ever consider that there might be such principles of mystical creation inherent to reality as those principles.
You know, it's very interesting. I'm glad you brought this up, because I want to just talk a little bit about this. I'm reading this book. I just got this book the other day, and it's called God and the New Atheism, A Critical Response to Dawkins, Harris, and Hitchens. And it's by this guy, John Hott, who's a professor he's a senior fellow in science and religion at Stock Theological Center at Georgetown University. And he's replying to Sam Harris's The End of Faith, to Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, and Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great. And He mentions Daniel Dennett in the introduction too, and science or religion as a natural phenomena. Anyway, well, he dubs these people the new atheists, and he kind of extrapolates from the work and says they share these common elements, and he addresses them. It's a very, very good book. It's very well written, and he pokes holes in their arguments about science and religion, and he says specifically, I'm arguing from essentially from a Christian perspective. And in his writing, he talks about the Bible, and he says, well, the Bible doesn't really contain material that applies to science and that addresses scientific issues, and that it's meant to on a different to be read on a different level. It's not to be read as a fundamental in a fundamentalist way, that the way that fundamentalist religious people and these science writers read it. But it's interesting because, well, a couple of things. One is that I note that a lot of the debate with these so-called new atheists and this God and religion versus science, the debate takes place in terms of Christianity and very often does not include any other religious traditions. But more to the point, nobody ever seems to recognize that within the esoteric aspects of religion, there are fundamental ideas about the nature of reality, which are certainly formulated in terms of mathematics, in terms of principles that can be investigated scientifically. It's completely absurd to say that there's nothing in there that really deals with anything that overlaps with science. I mean, I think I don't want to put words in this guy's mouth because I haven't read his entire book, but I think what he's arguing is that really science and religion deal with different domains. That's essentially the argument that, for instance, Stephen Jay Gould puts forward, and that really there's nothing in scripture that has applicability to issues in science. But I know that you disagree with that. I fundamentally disagree with that. And I see that's where I think when people don't deal with the esoteric side of things, that they don't really recognize this. Like, I've never heard anybody, like you say, talk about this 137 idea with this formulation. Never heard anybody really, I don't understand how anybody can say, oh, wait a minute, there's nothing really in religious teachings which has anything to do with which would be applicable to science. Well, the fundamental cosmic law of the law of three, which is in Hinduism, which is in Judaism, which is in Christianity, you know, I think that's a pretty fundamental idea about the nature of reality, and it's a mathematical idea, and it does have applicability to science. It's absurd to say that doesn't exist. That's because people don't recognize it. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's that people don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I would think even the book, the first chapter of the
book.
Well,
I knew that's exactly what you were going to respond with. You're going to talk about Genesis. And exactly, yeah. It's like to say, well, it's not like they don't have anything to say. It's, you know, of course they do. Or you know, the different teachings within all the esoteric teachings which talk about the cosmos emerging out of a singularity, out of a point source of light. You know, where do people think that this idea, this is pretty basic ideas, you know, before people formulated the Big Bang, people were talking about singularity conditions hundreds and thousands of years before this. It's like it's completely absurd to say that religious teachings have nothing to say about this. I find it odd that people who are theologians don't recognize this.
Yeah, well, I think it has to do with how people don't know the esoteric side of their own religious.
That's exactly
religion.
What it. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what
and,
it is.
And but once you begin to get the grasp those concepts, then I think those provide keys to understanding different mystical literature because then they take on new significance and you begin to see it. Those principles, and they are principles like which can be investigated and thought out scientifically. Like they have application. I don't know how to draw out all the implications and how to investigate it, but it certainly could be. I mean, you could have a whole department of knowledge that investigates mystical occult teachings. But in the modern world, I mean, there are only a few places in the world where they even study paranormal phenomena. But kind of no one really studies the esoteric mystical traditions to try to understand what might be in those teachings about creation physics or about the nature of human consciousness. Like, people don't have that perspective. And even the investigation of paranormal phenomena has been suppressed and repressed. I mean, there's only a few places in the world, like Rhine's work at Duke back in the 30s and 40s, and you know, you have Dean Radin out at the IONS Institute, who does very valuable work, and you have one or two places in England, I think, in Edinburgh and different places. But it's very rare that modern scientists or psychologists even consider these areas.
Yeah, you know,
and there's studies on paranormal phenomena, not really on the mystical side.
Yeah.
Why I formed Zero Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science, to try to develop this type of perspective.
In that connection, I just wanted to mention one thing, too, which I was going to ask you earlier, but I was going to comment earlier when you were talking about the heart doctrine. And this, again, goes to this whole, comprehensively what we've been talking about, is that realistically, how long do you think it took you to recognize the heart doctrine, to really understand that, geez, this is in everything? I mean, 15 years of study, 20 years of study, I mean, it didn't occur, like, I mean, you just didn't sort of read a couple of books and say, oh, I sort of recognize the heart doctrine, runs through all the major religious and esoteric mystical traditions. I mean, it requires a concerted act of a scholarship to arrive at this. And this is what people don't seem to understand. It's like, you can't just sort of sit down and figure this out, like, you know, in a couple of days. This is extremely complex and requires extensive effort to understand these things. And that's what's so kind of aggravating about all these people who talk off the top of their heads about the meaninglessness of mysticism who speak of it pejoratively. It's like, have you ever tried to study it? You know, like, have you ever actually investigated it? Have you looked at what mystical and esoteric teachings say? I mean, it's extremely involved in terms of trying to understand what they say. And then talked about repeatedly through these programs, your understanding is always shifting and your knowledge is always shifting. I mean, like, I would say, like, 10 years ago, even, I had, like, no clue about half of the things that we've talked about on this program.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that how this type of knowledge is something organic that grows in you over time.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that I could ever explain the heart doctrine to people such that they would then understand it and grasp it. It can't happen like that. You have to grow into the knowledge over a period of time, because you have to experience also what's being pointed to. You can't, I mean, you can understand it as an intellectual concept because it's totally rational. Doesn't mean it's true, but it is rational. The heart doctrine poses serious scientific hypothesis that can be investigated.
Okay.
But it goes back at least 20 years. It was in the beginning of the 80s. I think what first really made me awaken to this the heart doctrine as a scientific idea was when I was reading Prabhupada's copy of the Bhagavad Gita.
Right.
Because I was interested in consciousness and I'd been studying Gurdjieff. I focused on studying Gurdjieff for 10 years of mystical studies. But then I reading the Gita, and, you know, Lord Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all beings. You know, and I think it was the Bhagavad Gita and Prabhupada's explanations that really clarified it for me. And then it's over time, you know, with that understanding, then when I read Gnostic Christian teachings, you know, in the Nag Hammadi library, or I studied Kabbalah, then, you know, I think I originally realized it from Prabhupada's work and then reading the Upanishads of ancient India, because the heart doctrine is very clear, is clear in the Upanishads.
Right.
And then that provided the key, and then over time, I just saw it in more and more other teachings.
Yeah. And as I say, I just wanted to make that point, is that, you know, this is something in the heart doctrine, is that, you know, you've probably been writing that book for 15 or 20 years and rewriting it and revising it and everything.
Yeah.
And so it's amongst its other attributes, it's a very serious work of scholarship and comparative religious scholarship from a guy who's a psychologist, and it has obviously a huge psychological dimension, and it's got an entirely fantastic scientific dimension to it. So it has all these different elements to it, and they interact and reinforce and are integrated with one another. So it's a unique synthesis of religious and metaphysical and scientific and psychological and esoteric scholarship combined and brought together in a very provocative formulation of what it means to be a human being and what is the nature of the cosmos. You know, whether or not it's right or wrong, it's pretty fantastic. And, you know, I'll go on the record and say I think it is right, but, you know, I could be wrong.
Yeah, me too. Because everything points to it. It's consistent with everything. And there's nothing I know that refutes it. Whereas the modern viewpoint of the head doctrine, like, it's so superficial, and those scientists have to close their eyes to all the enigmas. So this can incorporate the enigmas and still maintain a scientific base. I noticed, Jim, we're coming down to a couple minutes here. We didn't get to the secret doctrine, so again, I'm going to plan to pick up on that next week. I'm almost done my revisions to the book, which have taken me 6 months, and it's kind of dragged me down a bit. It's taken so long, but I'm very pleased with the new edition I have. I hope to be finished by Monday, and I'm going to get a few copies that I'll print myself, and hopefully over the next month get it set up to produce as a trade paperback. But we'll return to the secret doctrine next week, and I would encourage people to have a look at my website, www.0point.ca. Unfortunately, most of my chapters from the Heart Doctrine up on my website are older versions, and they've been refined more. Hopefully, within the next month, I'll put up the final versions of the material from the Heart Doctrine. Any final comments, Jim? I think we're right down to the last few minutes here.
Evident Footprint, Thursday night, 10 Pacific, 1 a.m. Friday morning Eastern time. How's that? You're going to be on
with John. That's great. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Great. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, thanks, BBS, Don,
thanks.
Doug,
yeah.
Seth, all the crew there. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you all. Remember yourself. Remember the inevitability of your death.
And everyone around you.
Goodbye.